you doing, Met fans? Welcome back to another edition of the Terry Collins Show, presented by Tunnel the Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. I'm John Arezzi. It was a very good road trip for the New York Mets as they swept the Colorado Rockies and split a four-game series with the defending world champion Los Angeles Dodgers. Pete Alonso is on fire right now, and it's clicking for the Mets on all cylinders. We'll cover it all today with Mets beat writer Laura Albanese in just a bit, and later on we'll play a special Talking with TC Rewind with current Mets bench coach who celebrated his 63rd birthday this past Sunday, John Gibbons. Gibby is one of a kind for sure. We also have a new Tunnel to Towers Hero of the Week to honor on this week's show. So let's get right to the leadoff. Joining us back from the West Coast on her first extended road trip as Newsday's Mets beat writer. She's an analyst for SNY's Baseball Night in New York and co-host of the popular first-time listener, long-time caller podcast. Let's welcome back to the Terry Collins Show, Laura Albanese. Laura, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back, guys. It's good to be back in New York.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. You're obviously back from the trip, Los Angeles, then Denver, now home. Mets opening up a six-game homestand this week. Talk to us a little about how this last trip was. How was life on the road for an entire week?
I mean, it's actually a little bit easier to do things on the road because you're so close to the ballpark, and that's basically your entire life. You don't have to worry about cooking or cleaning your hotel room because someone does that for you. But it was a fantastic road trip for the Mets. That first series against the Dodgers had to be frustrating, even though they split it, just simply because they had every possibility of sweeping the Dodgers at home. And they just had a few get away from them. And then they did what they ought to do against the Rockies. The Rockies probably are not as bad as their record indicates, but I think you saw in the last two games exactly why they are where they are, which is that they don't really play clean baseball. And just mental mistakes on the base paths, you know, some misplays in the field, some errors, pitching staff was struggling. So, you have to take all three against the Rockies. There was no way around that one.
Yeah, it did. I want to definitely talk about the atmosphere at Coors Field as we get into the interview today. But I'm an old school guy. And when I was growing up, you know, the first thing I did every morning was to read the tabloids. It was the Post. It was Newsday. It was the Daily News. And that was like my fuel in the morning. And of course, you know, you can't get a newspaper anymore. But anyway, I woke up as I do now because everything is online. So, you know, I dive in and say, pour myself my first cup of coffee. And lo and behold, I see the back pages of today's Newsday, actually. And I think, Marsh, you have a photo of that back cover because my iPad, you know, won't show it as good as it can be. And I see this. So I'm like, wow. I mean, smart bombs, because I wanted to talk to you about Alonso. And here is this wonderful in-depth piece on Pete Alonso So, congratulations first and foremost on what a wonderful article about Complete Pete, diving deep with this guy who's a little quirky and everything. But talk to us about this article and how it came about and the scope of what you're talking about with Pete Alonso and the pitching coach Eric Chavez in this this wonderful deep dive into Alonso.
Yeah, thank you. So I kind of started not noticing it because I think Pete Alonso has kind of been undeniable all season. Yeah, he had a little bit of a swoon a few weeks ago, but this has just been an incredible season for him because he's not only hitting for power, which he's always hit for power, but he's also hitting for average, which has not necessarily been his game, and he's getting on base a ton. And so Francisco Lindor had mentioned it during the Rockies season that this could be his best season yet. And if you look at it, it's because he's becoming a very much a complete hitter. So I talked to Pete and I talked to hitting coach Eric Chavez about some of the kind of the differences from last year to this year, because last year, as we all know, he was going into what would be his big free agency year, what should have been his big free agency year. And he struggled at times at the plate. Yeah. He did not hit for average, really. I think he hit 240, which is kind of in the ballpark, but he also, the production wasn't there. His home run numbers were down. His RBIs were down. And when that happens to a player of Pete Alonso's caliber, especially going into such a big year, you kind of like, we're like, well, is this that kind of like famed decline that we see first baseman, power hitting first baseman go to? Granted, he's only 30 years old, but there is always that concern. And then, you know, the playoffs happen and he smashed that Devin Williams changeup. And to hear him talk about it, it does feel like something clicked in that he felt like himself, and that there were times during the 2024 season where he didn't feel like himself at the plate, and that that affected him. So he did some off-season work. Eric Chavez had mentioned that he had worked with somebody outside of the Mets to, you know, kind of look at some of the issues in his swing, look at his approach at the plate. And he is also studying a lot in terms of opposing pitchers, obviously, various tendencies. And he's bringing all that knowledge to his at-bats. And Chavez had mentioned that the one thing he looks at when it comes to Pete is not necessarily batting average, but on base percentage, because this is a guy who's so fearsome at the plate that pitchers don't want to necessarily throw him anything good. And so he should be getting a whole bunch of walks, but he doesn't necessarily walk a ton, but he's walking a lot more this year. So he's getting.
Yeah, it's a stark comparison from last year to this year. And I think there was a good chart that was put up in the article, and Marcia, if you could pull that up, I mean, it just shows the difference between last season and this season, between all of his numbers, all of the offensive categories. So if we can get that up, there you go. I mean, it's OPS, it's average, it's every indicator of a guy that has progressed and has changed his approach and did a lot of off-season work, as you mentioned. So for him, also his average of being 300 right now, he's never gone this deep into a season hitting 300. I think the latest, it was kind of mid, late April or early May at the latest. So he has kind of redeveloped himself in so many ways.
Yeah, I feel like he's reaching that next level. And yeah. Part of it has to do with the fact that, you know, he is not just coasting on talent, because he is super talented. He's a big, strong guy who can mash homers a really long way. And while that's all well and good, if you want to evolve as a hitter, I think it needs to be more about, okay, let me recognize pitch selection. Let me understand what pitchers are trying to do to me and why, and act and react. And so I think what we're seeing from Pete Alonso right now is just him maturing. But not only him maturing, but also having the self-awareness to be like, I cannot just coast on talent, because while that might be good for a little while, it's not going to be good 3 years from now, 6 years from now, when the physical gifts start declining.
Yeah. And his, you know, the home runs are coming at a rapid pace. I mean, this past road trip, you're talking 12 for 35 homers, 15 RBIs. I mean, he's almost reached, you know, with 60, what does he have, 61 RBIs now?
Yeah,
so it's crazy.
It's a lot of production. Yeah,
I mean,
and I think probably if you're a Mets fan, the best part of it for you is that it can be sustainable, because again, it's something that he's worked on. And the one thing with Pete is that he has been a streaky hitter, but if your mechanics are good and he worked on his mechanics, and if your pitch selection is good, it's easier to bust out of those streaks. So I do think, you know, if he keeps this going, he won't necessarily be as prone to those extended down moments that maybe we saw at other points in his career.
Yeah, and he looks like a completely different hitter now with two strikes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chase rate is very low.
He's got an eye, and he's understanding what's happening in the game around him, and it makes a big difference.
Yeah. Well, you know, he also, his defense has been fairly stellar as well. He's kind of the scoop master out there, and he's got some unbelievable plays that he's done in the field. He's still got the throwing is still a little problematic sometimes. but he's also having a lot of fun right now. You can just tell from staring down opposing players during national anthems to leg kicks and after victories. And he's just looking like he's having more fun this season than he's ever had before. And it's infectious, and it kind of spreads across the entire team.
Yeah, and I think that says a lot to his character because, you know, plenty of players could have had an offseason like he had where he didn't necessarily get the years or the money that he was looking for and come back dispirited or angry at his old team. And there isn't really a whiff of that. It's more just like, hey, I got to go back to the Mets. This is where I want to be. Let's win something.
Yeah, and he's certainly on that pace right now, as the entire team is. So, for him to come back with the 2-year deal, happy to be back in the Mets uniform. I couldn't even picture him being in someone else's uniform, to be honest with you. And I hope that it lasts for many, many years after this one. It's going to be a historic season for him. He's now only 9 home runs away from the all-time Mets lead. Daryl Strawberry is the next guy on the list, the last guy on the list. David Wright, he just surpassed his home run total on this trip, and David sent a nice video out congratulating him. So it's going to be quite a celebration, and now it's just kind of a countdown, whether it's going to happen before the All-Star game, around the All-Star game, right after the All-Star game, but it's coming, and it's going to be a wonderful celebration, one that happens for all the Met fans, and just hope he gets to do it at home, because that would be off the chart. So,
yeah, I think everyone's looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Well, the Mets also having fun with the rest of the National League East teams all seem to be slumping at just the right time while the Mets go out on the West Coast and win as many games as they have. They won 5 of 7 on the trip, 12 of their last 16 games. They have a 4-game lead over the Phillies, which just a couple of weeks ago was just the opposite. And you're now covering the team every day on the road, and you're in the clubhouse. So I'm sure the mood in the clubhouse right now and across this entire team is pretty much a fun ride.
Yeah. I mean, I asked Carlos Mendoza about this during the Dodger series, where we saw kind of like the resurgence of the Soto shuffle and Luis Angel Acuna having like catching gear on in the dugout and guys just having fun and bottle flipping. And they were doing this against, you know, the team that was supposed to be the best team in the National League, but that's a mess. And the team that ousted them in the NLCS. And I do think playing loose in those situations is really important. It's a carryover, even though this is a different team from last year's team. It does feel like a carryover from last year's team, which is like, get your business done, but also have a little bit of fun, because when you're playing too tight, that can almost make you too precious at the plate or too precious when you're pitching. And when that happens and you're not just acting and reacting, you can get in your head a little bit and suddenly the results aren't there anymore.
Yeah. And all the fun that they're having, that carryover effect, is missing one piece. And that's OMG, Jose Iglesias. But when you look at what David Stern did, and the reason that Jose Iglesias is not on the team this year, is to give the young guys a shot. And boy, have these kids have gotten their opportunity. And now you got Mauricio, who hit probably one of the – you were there. I mean, that home run
was going. I'm like, where did it end up?
It was insane.
It was a third decker. I don't know if I've seen one of those.
And that was incredible. But you have Mauricio, then you got Acuna and Beatty, and Vientos is on the IL right now. But these young kids are, really starting to they add a little extra excitement to everything, and they're young and fresh, and they'll do anything to assist and help the team. But Mauricio is going to be a factor. I really feel he had that rough start. Then he comes back, he starts hitting better, and that bomb of a home run. And so there's going to be some tough decisions here really soon.
Yeah. I mean, there's only so much. That's the thing with these young kids is that, wow, they're producing and that's fantastic, but you also need to play them because that's how they continue to develop. So if there's not enough playing time, you look at someone like Acuna, who hasn't really had a lot of playing time. Like, what do you do with him? Can you continue to develop him if he's not playing? Is he better served by going to AAA? So these are the conversations that they have to keep having. I did ask Carlos Mendoza about this. He said that even if, you know, a guy like Acuña is not playing, there is a way to continue his development and his maturation at the coaching level. It's something that Mendoza has a lot of experience with because he was a player development guy. You know, he started with like the Gulf League Yankees and he worked his way up. So he knows how to kind of like take these young guys and help them along the process. And I think we did see that with Mauricio, because the minute he was called up, the first thing Mendoza says is let's be patient with him. He's not going to be our savior. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's an indication that, you know, those conversations are had behind closed doors where it's like, we're going to be patient with you. Don't feel like, you know, every at bat is going to make or break your career. Just kind of go through your process. And what happens? You give him that vote of confidence. You let him play a couple games in a row. And suddenly Mauricio is not only hitting bombs and stealing bases, but he's also walking, and this is a player who's known to be a free swinger. Yep. So I think those are all kind of interesting developments. It's early. He's gonna go through swoons like everybody else, but, you know, that's a good sign.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly a great time to see these youngsters performing the way they're doing, and it just leads to a really cool situation for the New York Mets as we go forward with all these young talents that are being developed and making an impact. The kids are stepping it up. And you wrote about that whole thing in Newsday a few days ago as well. So I wanted to go back to Colorado for a second, just because of what I noticed more than anything else for a team that could be the worst team in the history of Major League Baseball at the end of the season. The place was packed, it looked, for 3 days.
Yeah.
So what do you attribute? Would there like tons of Met fans there, or is just kind of like they're drawing really well? I think their average attendance is like 29,000 a game. So I was kind of amazed at like, look at the attendance here.
Yeah, it's almost too bad because that means that ownership won't do anything to change, because what Manfred has done to the Rockies is egregious in terms of they're not really giving them a fighting chance in terms of personnel. That being said, there were a good number of Rockies fans there. Were there Mets fans? Yeah, it was probably a 2/3, 1/3 split, I would say. You know, when the Mets started pulling away, there were some pretty loud chants. There were some loud MVP chants for Francisco Lindor, so there were definitely a lot of Mets fans. But Rockies fans show up. They've showed up in the past. They have had a rough stretch for a while. They were good a few years back, but you know, it's a good baseball town, and it's a fun ballpark in the middle of downtown. It's a good way to spend an afternoon, even if the product is not necessarily what you would call elite major league level.
Yeah, it's unfortunate for the fan base, but they're attending anyway. But yeah, it does show that ownership is like, well, we're drawing them anyway, so what do we have to spend more money? So that's
right.
That's something you don't want to see happen, and it's sad for the fans in Colorado because they're such a seem to be such a loyal fan base there. You touched upon Lindor for a second, and he has been amazing. As you wrote this week, he's on a mission, even with 9 functioning toes. So from his pinch hit, game-winning hit on Friday of last week to stealing the 2 bases on Saturday, where that was kind of like deking everybody out, I think. I mean, because everyone is like, the guy has a broken toe, and there he is, stealing bases. He's indeed, as you said, keeping his toe in the game, which was kind of cool. Talk to us about Lindor and this mission that he's on right now.
You know, he mentioned it last year during the playoffs, and he is, for the longest time, he was known as Mr. Smile because he has this big, bright smile and kind of like this jovial guy, but he is very one-minded. NLCS didn't really mean much for him last year, in so much as he wants to win a World Series with the Mets, and he will do absolutely everything in his power to get there. So he's very serious about that mission. And you see, like, this is a guy who does not miss games unless he absolutely, absolutely has to. He breaks his toe on Tony Gonsolin's, it was like an 89-mile-per-hour slider, right to the foot, and he plays on it for 9 innings. That was the first inning of the game. And he was like, well, I wasn't sure if it was broken, but then I took off my sock and I saw there was black and blue, and I don't bruise easily, so I know something was up. And the fact that he gets the diagnosis and is on the team bus and is telling Carlos Mendoza, put me in the lineup the next day on this show. And Mendoza's like, no, what? And he only, you know, he only missed, was it two games? And then he has that pinch hit. That pinch hit, double to win the game. And after he's walking towards us, his foot is completely bandaged. Like, this thing is huge. And you realize how much pain, you know, Lindor must be going through just to be out there every day. Even after yesterday's game, you know, he was walking around the clubhouse. It wasn't all bandaged, but he had a pretty sizable limp. And you can't really tell when he's on the field. So he's definitely playing through the pain. He's going to be playing through the pain until this thing fully heals, which the timeline for that is about 6 weeks.
Wow.
So he has proven that he can kind of compartmentalize. I don't know how. I would not be able to. But, you know, the production is there.
Yeah, it is. And, he's a gamer for sure. And when he had that broken finger several years ago, I mean, he played. So he's an amazing player, and he is a team leader, and he's having fun out there, and it's good to see him doing what he's doing each and every day for the New York Mets. Somebody else has been smiling a little bit more frequently these days, and that's I guess you call him Happy Jeff McNeil.
It is Happy Jeff, yeah.
Yeah, because there are two sides of this guy. There's Happy Jeff, and then there's Grumpy Jeff, but he's Happy Jeff right now.
Well, yeah, I feel like Jeff McNeil takes his successes and his failures really personally, which is probably what you want, you know, in a competitor. And with three home runs in the last two games, he had two yesterday, power numbers ticking up. He's making contact. He looks comfortable at the plate. Mendoza just said, like, this is the version. There's a lot of versions of Jeff McNeil, and this is the version we want to see. And it's a player that swings with authority, not necessarily swinging just to make contact, but to make quality contact. And when Jeff McNeil is doing that, I mean, we have to remember that this player was a batting champ. Granted, they banned the shift, certain other things happened, and he also changed his approach at the plate, so he hadn't been hitting for average to that batting champ level in the last couple seasons. But if he's hitting the ball hard, you get what you want from him, because he knows how to square up. So if you're squaring up already and you're also hitting the ball hard, you're going to make quality contact.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that OPS of his is really, that was pretty eye-opening for me when I saw him at an 888 OPS. And that's second on the Mets, just under Pete.
Yeah.
So he's got reason to smile. We like this version of Jeff. We like the Happy Jeff. If you're a Mets fan, you're as I am, as you know, I enjoy this version of Jeff. Finally, when you have to talk about success of a team, it usually starts with pitching. And now with the Mets, their pitching staff is very stingy with the ERA. Four or five guys are under three. And I believe the last time this happened for the Mets was back in 1985, where they had four starters that all had ERAs at this point of the season under three. So whatever is happening there is just simply amazing, and more reinforcements are coming with Sean Manaea and Frankie Montas both on rehab assignments now. And how do you see Mendy and David Stearns handling this upcoming glut of starting pitchers while managing what is an overtaxed bullpen?
Right. And so, I mean, that overtaxed bullpen part is the thing that gives me pause, because, you know, your answer would probably be like, oh, go to a six-man rotation. That way you can save Kodai Senga a little bit more and a guy like Clay Holmes, who's a converted reliever. But can you really have one less arm in the bullpen when the starters aren't necessarily going that long? I don't have the answer to this. I don't know what they're going to do. You know, there's going to be – Manaea is going to take some time. His rehab clock just started a couple days ago, so you have 30 days before you have to come back when your rehab clock starts. Frankie Montas' rehab clock is about to expire, but he has been getting kind of lit up in AAA, so that's going to be interesting to see how they kind of integrate him and whether or not those results in AAA are indicator that he's also going to struggle at the major league level. And I do think that's something they're concerned about. I don't know what they do. Do you put Tyler McGill in the bullpen? Because it's something that people have been talking about for years, because he has the type of stuff that would probably play really well in a relief role, but who knows if he'll excel there. You gotta pitch Peterson. You gotta pitch Clay Holmes. You gotta pitch Kodai Senga. So I am looking forward to seeing it. I do not have the answers, but I'm sure David Stearns has something cooking up.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. And even with Paul Blackburn coming in and being able to eat up some innings this past weekend. So, yeah, they got a lot of good problems to have. They really do. But when and this will be the last thing we discuss today. But as we get closer to the trading deadline, for the first time in a long time, the Mets seem pretty set in so many positions. So when Met fans typically, as you know, by covering the team over the years, it's like that trade deadline is get this guy, get that guy, get this guy. You don't hear any of that on talk radio. You don't hear any of that talk for the first time in recent memory or in all of my memory going back over the course of many years following the team. Is there a move that the Mets perhaps, in your opinion, maybe be looking for? Is it center field? Is it another bat? You know, I don't think it's pitching.
Not necessarily pitching, but you know, sometimes I look at that bullpen and they do miss having a guy like AJ Minter, which is like your kind of like your bridge to Edwin Diaz. Reed Garrett has been great. Wascar Brazoban has been great. But these guys are getting, as we mentioned before, super taxed because it's not just the number of innings that you're pitching. It's the number of high leverage innings that you're pitching. And that's going to have an effect. So I think, you know, you always keep an eye out for a high average, high leverage reliever if you can. The rest is difficult because let's say you want like a true third baseman, you know, somebody who could really play the position. You're going to do that at the expense of playing time for Mark Vientos, who granted struggled at the plate. What if Ronnie Mauricio hits up? It goes back to we want to see the young guys because these guys could be the cornerstone of this franchise for a long time. You have a guy in center field in Tyrone Taylor, which, okay, so maybe you want like a more productive bat, but Taylor's hitting pretty well too, and that defense is
otherworldly.
It's a black hole out there. So, I mean, again, good problems to have. It's kind of like an embarrassment of riches. They don't necessarily have to get anything big, but maybe like an extra piece or two or a true DH, who knows, because Jesse Winker has not even resumed baseball activities.
Yep.
So, again, these are all like little nitpicks, little things here and there. My true concern, again, is just whether or not the pitching staff, the bullpen in particular, can kind of stay the course down the road just because of how much they're pitching.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, as always, it's always a pleasure to have you here with us. And I would like you to plug your social media, and also for anybody out there that, you know, you don't have to be in New York to get Newsday. I mean, you go online, and, you know, as far as the comprehensive coverage that Laura's providing the fans right now, go to newsday.com, I would say, and just kind of download that app. And so you could read her wonderful coverage of the Mets each and every day now. So Laura, please let people know where to find you on social media.
Sure. You can get me on X, Albanese Laura. I'm on Instagram, Laura Writes Stuff. And I co-host a podcast with my friend Cole Critchell called First Time Lifter, Long Time Caller, which you can listen to on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Excellent. Well, always a pleasure to see you, and we hope to see you real soon, Laura. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Great leadoff with Laura Albanese. Really always a pleasure to have her on this program. We'll be bringing her back in a few weeks, and Andy Martino will be joining us again in a few weeks. So with all this latest Mets news and how great the season has been, it's great to have these insiders on with us and TC. So let's talk about our presenting sponsor, our friends at Tunnel to Towers. The Tunnel to Towers Foundation has expanded its student athlete advocacy program. This is a way for college athletes to grow their own brand while at the same time explain the Tunnel to Towers mission to a younger generation. The newest advocates are Caitlin Collins, a lacrosse player at Rutgers, and Jack Hole, a water polo player at Penn State Barand. They'll be speaking about the foundation, sharing its stories on their own social media feeds. You can learn more about the program by going to t2t.org. and Tunnel to Towers is continuing its mission to do good, born from the tragedy of 9/11. T2T has provided mortgage-free homes for Gold Star and fallen first responder families with young children and catastrophically wounded veterans. To date, the foundation has delivered 1,500 homes to those who have served. You can help them continue their work by donating $11 per month at t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. And the FDNY Boxing Club will be fighting on June the 13th on behalf of Tunnel of Towers. If you like action, you'll want to see the Thriller in Camilla. The FDNY boxers will take on other first responders at St. Camellius in Rockaway Beach, that is in New York. These men and women get after it, and the punching is nonstop. Proceeds of this event is going to benefit Tunnel to Towers. We will return with a special Talking with TC Rewind with Mets bench coach John Gibbons right after this message from Terry Collins on behalf of Tunnel to Towers.
I'm former Mets manager Terry Collins. The Tunnel Towers Foundation is very important to me, and I look for ways to try to support them any way I can. If a first responder is killed in the line of duty, T2T will pay off the mortgage for their family. That's just one of the ways T2T makes a difference. You can support their cause as well by donating $11 a month. Go to t2t.org. Let's go Mets, and let's help Tunnel Towers.
Our special guest today on Talking with TC was a former first-round draft pick of the Mets back in 1980, the third selection behind second-round pick Billy Bean, or actually in the first round, but the second selection for the Mets, Billy Bean, and the number one pick that year, Daryl Strawberry, not bad company for our guest to be around. In 1980, he is a member of the 1986 World Championship Mets, a longtime manager in their minor league system, who went on twice to manage the Toronto Blue Jays, where he remains a cult hero in the country of Canada. He was hired by the Mets, come back to the organization this season, and serves as the bench coach for Carlos Mendoza. His 2023 memoir, Gibby, Tales of a Baseball Lifer, documented his long career in the game. He's my former roommate, and from 2022 to 2023, our host, I had the honor of co-hosting the Gibby Show podcast with him. It's a pleasure to bring on to Talking with TC Gibby, Mr. John Gibbons. Welcome to Talking to with TC, Mr. John Gibbons.
Hey, well, it's about time you guys had me on here, for crying out loud. Hey, it's good to see everybody. I go way back with TC. I don't know if everybody knows that. You know, he was my manager in 1988, Albuquerque Dukes. You know, I got traded in spring training for Craig Shipley, and I went over there, and it was a pleasure to get to know him. I gotta say this. TC was the hardest working guy I ever played for in baseball. And the guy, nobody cared more about doing things right. And I'm sure he'll mention some things today in our show. But it was an honor and pleasure. You know, I didn't play real well for him. It was a stop along the way for me. But I got a lot of great memories. We had a good team.
John, nice to have you on. Thanks for doing this. I know you're coming off a long road trip. You're probably exhausted. So taking the time out is certainly, we really appreciate it.
Hey, T, you know what? The thing about being exhausted, I tell people this all the time. The bench coach job is a job to have, man. You know, it's like, you know, when the game's over, you got to go in there and talk to the media, especially in a town like this. The bench coach, he goes home especially get a little older and you have this job, you got other people around there doing all of the dirty work that those guys used to do. And it's been a pretty good gig. I've enjoyed it.
You know, John, obviously, you know, from transfer, when you first started managing in the minor leagues and then you got to the big leagues as a manager, you know, the game has really evolved. Some of the new rules, some of the, you know, the way the game is being played today, has it been tough, you know, from the kind, cause you know, yeah, you did play for me and I will tell you, I loved it. I loved every second having you on the club. But has it been tough? Has it been a tough change to see the way the game has evolved today?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's completely different. You know, you mentioned the rules, right? You know, the only rule I really like is the pitch clock, right? And even at first, I thought I wasn't a big fan of it when I was on the outside looking in, because I knew I had pitchers in the past that had trouble when they work too fast, right? Even though I thought it would benefit from them, and they needed to take their time. I thought, well, why punish a guy that this makes him successful, right? But it does pick up the pace of the game, and I think that's worked fine. As far as, you know, some of the rule changes, I don't like, you know, being an ex-manager like you. I don't like the three batter minimum. I think that kind of hamstrings you a little bit as far as strategy wise. You know, I never liked to play at the home plate and the sliding rule at second because, you know, those are big parts of the game, the aggressive parts of the game that people love, you know, and I think we got a little bit soft as an industry. So, you know, and now analytics, you know, the big part, you know, is really big, right? And I've had to adjust to that and learn some new things. I still can't figure out all the terminology they use, you know. But you know what? It's just the most important thing of all. It goes back to the basics. The teams that pitch better, they hit better, they field, they do all the fundamental things. Those are the teams that are going to come out on top. You know, we can get some benefits from all the new info. But you still got human beings got to still go out there and play and execute, and the teams that do it better, they win.
You know, I agree with you. I go back many years ago to where Walter Alston, when I first started managing in the minor leagues, you know, he had retired as the big league manager in Los Angeles, and he was kind of going through, and he told me one time, he said, you know, no matter what you say, no matter what you do, no matter how much you think you can get, you know, certain guys better, and maybe you'll get some guys better, but talent's going to win. Talent's always going to play, and I always thought that. So, John, you know, I don't, since I'm not in the locker rooms anymore, and I read papers and I listen. So one of the things I knew for a long time, John, managing, is that players got sick of meetings. They don't, you know, the more it seemed like the more meetings you had, there were more problems. So, but I'm hearing today there's like a hitter's meeting every day. Is that true? Is that what goes on? And I mean, those guys got to get. For years ago, guys used to keep books on every pitcher. They knew what they were going to face. Are there that many meetings that are taking place before a game?
Yeah, and it's a real quick one. They just go over there and they go over the pitch that day's pitcher, maybe some tendencies or things like that. And then I think most of the work's done. You know, the hitting coaches will you know go up to whoever it might be and say, hey, this is how he's probably going to approach you. But they kind of get together. I don't know if that's standard everywhere, but our guys get together for a little short, quick meeting. You know, and hey, I'm with you. You know, it used to be, it's almost like when you have a child, right? So the more you talk, the less they listen. I thought, you know, but that's, I mean, that's big in the business nowadays. There's no question about it. And hey, when you mentioned Walter Alston and talent, TC, I got a quick funny story that this is analytics at its best, in my opinion, right? Remember big Frank Howard, Hondo, everybody knows Frank, right? Frank, I was sitting in spring training when he was a coach for the Mets here back in, I was sitting there one day and he said, son, he said, you look in your dugout, you got two cannons, then you look in the other dugout and they got five or six cannons. He said, you may win a battle, you ain't winning the war. And I said, that's it, summed up right there. In 162 games, the team with the most talents usually come out on top. You know, I think there's a couple teams that overachieve every year, a couple that underachieve, but you find your level at 162 games regardless.
And, John, you know, you're back in New York. Right. It's been where you started. You were drafted in 1980. You know, were part of that 86 World Championship team.
Small part, very small part.
Well, you were there. You were there. And also managed in the system with the Mets for many, many years. How was it like to be back in New York to feel the energy of the city? And the second part of that question is like, as a San Antonian, how is it like being like staying in New York for you? What a culture change. So kind of describe that for us, please.
Well, it's funny, you know, when I first got here, you know, I was 21 when I made the team in 84, you know, they were like a rebuilding team and I had a good spring and they were looking for guys. Right. And so I come up here and I remember the we started on the ropes, but we opened up at home against the Expos. And I remember the first day I was catching the home opener here at Shea, and it was Pete Rose was playing first for the Expo. He comes to the plate and like he's standing in the box and like somebody threw, I think it was a grapefruit or something, comes flying through. I'm going, where the heck am I, man? And you know, and even the hotel when we first got to New York off the road trip, you know, it was like the hotel. I mean, it was noisy. There are people everywhere. There's cars up on blocks out in the parking lot. I'm going, I said, I, you know, I saw the movie Escape from New York, man, when I was younger. I said, this is it. So I tell you what, now that I'm older and I got a better appreciation of things, I've enjoyed it so much more. You know, I live close to the ballpark, you know, so I don't have to drive around this place, you know. But it's definitely a different world. And, you know, nobody knows it better than TC as long as he was here. You know, you just got to ride the emotional roller coaster here with him. And you got to have a thick skin. Maybe that's part of the reason I said that the bench job is a way to go, TC, because, you know, when you're managing here, now Carlos is managing, you guys are taking the shots. You know, the bench coach, he just kind of sneaks in and out. Maybe that's part of it.
The game has changed probably in a lot of ways since you were in the dugout for the Blue Jays leaving in 2018. What have you noticed most about the changes in baseball since you were last in the dugout?
The iPads on the bench, probably. the game is so much more advanced technically, technology-wise and things like that. That's kind of when I got back in. That was kind of, used to have guys could go up and look at in between innings. They could look at their bats on computers, you know, up in the clubhouse, right? And then they kind of banned that when they got a little suspicious of that. But now they're on the bench. Everybody's looking at iPads, and instead of watching the game half the time, I'm going, what the heck, you know. I even catch myself glancing at them every now and then. So that's different, you know. It's probably, baseball really is a simple game, you know, when it gets down to it, right? But it's so advanced now, it just seems kind of odd at times that this game, you know, it's like in the football's, you know, X's and O's are everything, right? Baseball, I still think the game's going to lay itself out for you, you know, and how you want to react to it, you know, whether it's you want to hit and run, bunt, things like that, which are very rare nowadays. It's there for you if you want, or a pitch and change, what have you. It's not like you're trying to, you're not going to outsmart a lot of guys in this game. If you pay attention to the game, you know, they say sometimes guys do too much on their gut instinct. And I don't buy that. I said, it's your eyes will tell you what's going on, you know, the pitcher's losing it, this and that, all that. And I think that's still big in the game, although it's, you know, that's debatable in today's game, but it's just but you know, you have to be able to adjust with it. There's no doubt about it. I just think with the technology and you know me, I'm not very good with a computer anyway, so that's been a real battle, you know, to just get that thing up and running. But it's still the greatest game there is.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, like we said earlier, the teams that do the basic things right and have more firepower usually are going to be all right in the end.
Yeah. I want to throw it back to Terry, John. Thanks, man.
So, Gibby, you know, one of the things, obviously, I've managed in different spots. And, you know, the big question is, you know, what changes have you made from the last job to this one? So I would hope that you're probably hoping that there's a managing job here in the near future for you again. What changes would you try to make from when you managed in Toronto to your next job?
Well, you know, I don't know what's ahead for me, to be honest with you, but I will tell you this, I've always viewed myself as being a treat the guys like men, and I'll always, if I look back, I'd say, you know, I think I was fair to everybody. You know, I didn't, of course, some guys had more playing time and things like that, and you had your battles with certain guys, but I thought I was fair. I just think, you know, you, as you get older and you mature, you look back on things, you know, it's such a right in how you handle people. And sometimes you got to kick them, you know. We live in a day and age, you know, where everybody's, you know, you gotta smooth everything over, and everybody's got a psychologist. But sometimes, you know, a kick is the answer too, right? But so you look at those things. Well, could I handle this situation better? Maybe I could get it better. Those are probably the things. And the fact that, you know, we were talking about analytics a while ago. There is a lot of good new information out there that can help you. I think as far as, you know, we were talking about the three batter minimum, analytics is helpful in that area, you know, matching up your, you know, those three guys, you know, with all the, but overall, you know, strategy wise, you learn some things over time, but I think if, you know, if you're fair to everybody, you know, I think out on top, just like I just told you a minute ago, man, that bench job is a pretty good job. So, man, yeah. Read between the lines.
You know, and I'll tell you, John, you know, and I knew you probably did too, but I'm telling you, there, you know, when I first started managing, when I first got my first job in Houston, Matt Galante, who had already been, he'd been with the team for a long time, he was there, and I was talking to him about a bench coach, and he said, "You don't need a bench coach." He said, "You know, I know I've seen you manage. I managed against you in the minor leagues. You know, you don't need a bench coach." Well, I will tell you, the game progressed to the point where bench coaches now, as you know, I mean, years ago when you were a bench coach, when I first started, the third base coaches were the guys who got the jobs. Then, you know, the opening job, they were the ones who were being interviewed. And now it's the bench coaches, because that job has evolved to such a point where, you know, a lot of times, you know, after the manager makes a decision, the player comes out and he's all upset about something, it's the bench coach who goes over and calms that guy down. It's the bench coach who's the first guy that, you know, and so I think that job has really evolved, and I can see now why, you know, that has become such a big job. And I also know in some teams, I did it with Bob Guerin, but he handled all of the data that we got, you know, he put all of the scouting reports together. So I know that job has really evolved, and they got the right guy in New York. And I just want to wish you the best, and hopefully, you know, you guys get hot again and get right back really in the main hunt of everything, because that's when it's so exciting. So, hey, John, I know you got to go here pretty soon, but John's also got some questions from some fans I know he wants to ask you.
All right, here we go. We're going to get to the questions right now, and I'll pull them up here now. First question comes from Mark from Toronto. And this is for both TC and for you, Gibby. Both of you are highly respected for your leadership abilities. Which individuals were some of the biggest influences on developing your leadership style, and what did they teach you? Gibby first, then TC.
Gosh, you know what? You know, you look back over at your career and, you know, the certain guys you play for that, you know, you take something from everybody, right? There's guys you like, certain guys you don't like. They got good qualities, good traits, or you play better under them for some reason because of the way they handle you. And, you know, I had some good ones. Chuck Killer was the first guy. He was my first manager after I got drafted. And then when I got into coaching, he was my roommate, actually, because he was still an advisor in the Mets organization. And he kind of had some rough edges about him. And he helped me out quite a bit, you know, on some things. Daryl Johnson, DJ, you know, managed the 75 Red Sox back then. And he used to come around when I was managing the minor leagues, and he'd talk to the coaches as well as the players, you know. But they all touch you in a certain way. You know, I said earlier about TC, I don't think I've ever been around a hard – I know I haven't – a harder-working guy than him, and a guy that cared more about the playing the game right. You know, that rubs off on you, you know. There's – Davey Johnson, when he was managing New York, you know, Davey was didn't say much, but he was a very confident guy. So I think everybody, and there's guys I play for that I could care less about, right? It doesn't mean they're bad guys, but you didn't like the way they did it, or maybe they didn't, you know, they just weren't men's men type guys, you know? So you take something from everybody, I think, you know, discard some things, and then it really comes down to what my personality is. And TC's person, we all have our own personality. And you gotta live that, and you gotta use that, because, you know, otherwise you're a phony, you know, and they read right through you. And in the end, you know, it comes back to how many cannons you got in the dugout. It always does.
You know, John, you're absolutely right. And that is the truth. That is exactly the truth. You take something from everybody. You know, I used to say, I'd listen to, you know, I played for Del Crandall in Albuquerque, and Del was a great manager, tough guy. Tough, you know, but because he demanded the game being played the right way. But you learn stuff from him. I learned stuff, you know, when I first got to probably my main mentors, Jim Leland. And I watched him deal with players and stuff. But, you know, there were also times I also saw him, like you said, you know, He could kick, you know, I saw him. I was 2 feet away when he and Bonds got into it. I was, you know, 3 feet away and he and Andy Van Slyke got into it. So, I mean, there were times that, hey, look, you got to take a stance. And so I saw how he handled players. I spent 30 minutes with Sparky Anderson one day talking about managing in the big leagues. I mean, you say, you know what, I'm going to remember that and I'm going to use that. And then obviously, you know, when I came back and got the job in New York after, you know, not managing for a long time, the one thing I said is I'm going to have some fun now. I'm going to enjoy the game now. I have, you know, I'm an intense guy. I had to play harder than everybody else to succeed in the game. And so, you know what, I'm going to enjoy it myself. And I thought that translated to the players, just as you said. You know, Walter Alston told me years ago, the players will take on the personality of the manager. Make no mistake about it. So, and I always thought, you know what, I could get everybody to play as hard as I did, I got a chance to win. Because we're going to play the game hard, we're going to run balls out, and we're going to do the little things. So, but I think you're right, John. I think it's just, you know, you take the things you learn, you use them, but you are absolutely right. You cannot change who you are because the players, they will read right through you. And so just be yourself again.
Exactly.
Excellent. I got a question from our Instagram account. This comes from John Woodward. John, in 1986, you were called up after Gary Carter got injured, so clearly you weren't going to get a lot of playing time. That being said, you hit .474 that year. Do you?
Holy man! What's the most damage in that team?
How could they ever play Carter again after?
Oh, the hell, how did he get back in the lineup? He sounds like he got Wally Pipped to me. That's all I can tell you.
Exactly.
John, do you think your career would have continued had you been on a team where there wasn't a Hall of Fame catcher in front of you?
No. You know what? I had opportunities after '88 in spring training, I got traded over to the Dodgers. DC was a manager, and I had playing opportunities. Right, you know, our other catcher there, TC, played us every. You know, we alternated. Gil Reyes, and Gil had the better year, right? And so, you know what? My thing, I got there quick, struggled, and lost my confidence, and then really, you know, I forgot how to do it, right? And it's happened to many guys. And I'm always conscious of that now once I got into coaching, you know. But, no, I had plenty of opportunities. If I had produced, you know, people say injuries here. Yeah, everybody goes through injuries, but, you know, I can't use that as an excuse because, that .474, that was just in this limited playing time. You look at my bubblegum card, it might say .174. Hey, but you know what, though? That doesn't matter nowadays, batting average. I want to make a comeback. It doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, you had a four-hit game, didn't you also? Wasn't there like a four-hit game in September after the clincher and you hit a home run and got like a big night that night?
Yeah, well, I got caught up in the wave, man. That team was rolling.
We got just two more questions for you. This next one comes also from Instagram. Eric Soli asks, Gibby, what was it like to manage the Toronto Blue Jays not once but twice, and give us your most memorable moment as a Jay skipper?
Well, it's kind of unusual unless you win, you know. It's like I'm Billy Martin coming back, but you know, Billy won, you know. So the fact that I went back twice, you know, Alex Anthopoulos took over the second time, and he was an friend of mine. That's the way a lot of times it works. But I was pretty fortunate to do that. You know, the first go round didn't go real well, but we didn't have that many cannons either. You know, I'm not making excuses, but you know, that's back when the Yankees were the Yankees, the Red Sox were the Red Sox. You know, but the fact that I got a chance to come back, you know, is very unusual unless you've done something. You know. But in a lot of ways, too, I approached that second go-around, like TC was mentioning a minute ago, that he was going to enjoy it, you know, when he got to New York. And I kind of took the same idea. You know, I've done this before. I'm going to try to enjoy a little bit more, maybe, you know, lighten up a little bit with certain things. But, you know, the bottom line there is we acquired some better players. You know, we had Josh Donaldson. Batista was there the second go-around. And they were probably the two most despised guys in the league, but yet two of the better players in the league, right? And so we had some firepower in Encarnacion, Russell Martin. So we were much better. And my job was just to get the most out of them and get out of the way where I had to, right? But it had been such a long time since a team had won anything there or even played games that mattered in September. And we heard that, you know, I heard that year after year after year. And to finally be there, we won the division in 15. trade deadline pickups. So that's my fondest moment there, you know, because, you know, the whole country came alive, right? And they told me all along, they told everybody, said, you know, if this team is relevant in September, watch what happens to the city and the country. But we were never relevant, you know, so we didn't know. And then finally we were, and that's what happened. And we exploded, the country exploded, and too bad, if we'd won a couple more games, we might have played TC in that World Series, but we couldn't get there. So, but that's my fondest memory there. Finally being with the team there, that after all those years, they were starved, to be part of that.
Yeah, big season for you. Final question, also from Instagram, and this comes from Johnny A 125, and I'll have to do a little bit of self-disclosure. That's me. So my question, Gibby, is, do you miss podcasting?
Yes and no. I miss sitting here BSing with guys, you guys like that. I don't miss trying to track down guests to come on the show.
That's what I know. I'm sure TC could relate to that as well. You know, it's not an easy gig for sure, tracking guys down. But we had a whole season and a quarter of another season. So, each and every week it was great. The guests you got were great. Your insights were great. And it was very cool to be able to have that opportunity and that experience with you, John. But you were a good podcaster. People liked you, man.
Well, sometimes you throw some little BS around, you know, even if it's not always in your nature. Hey, people buy anything nowadays. You're crying out loud.
Awesome. Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. Hey,
TC and I might not even said a truthful word today, and people would never know that.
They wouldn't know the difference. That's right.
A great rewind with John Gibbons, the current Mets bench coach, who celebrated that 63rd birthday this past weekend. And now it's time for the Tunnel to Towers Hero of the Week. This week, we honor fallen hero, Mission, Texas police officer, Jose Luis Esposito. Let's go to that right now.
My name is Bobby Espericueta, and my husband was Jose Luis Espericueta. Everybody knew him as Speedy. He was a police officer for the Mission Police Department in Mission, Texas. He wanted to make a difference. He wanted to do something better. He loved doing what he did, and he did it with a passion. It was a Thursday. We were all home at the time. His best friend finally called me back, and he said, I need you to go to the hospital. I could hear them working on him, and to this day, I still hear. And shortly after that, the doctor came out and just said that we had lost him, and I just dropped to the ground, and everything else from that night was a blur. They later told me about the incident, and it was a son who had shot at his mom. And in a split second, with no aim whatsoever, the suspect was able to grab his gun and shot my husband. My world was turned upside down. I wasn't sure how I was gonna move forward, let alone, you know, on my own. My son, when it happened, was 12 at the time, and my daughter was 19. You know, one of the biggest fears was trying to have that normalcy in our life after everything that happened. I wanted my kids to be okay. You know, shortly after it happened, Frank Siller actually contacted my brother, and he kind of like told him, like, this is what our foundation does, and this is what we want to do for her. The Tunnel to Towers Foundation paid off our mortgage. The grieving part of it is forever. But just knowing that our mortgage is paid off, it's just like a sense of relief, a sense of just peace. I can't even describe it. Tunnel to Towers Foundation. Let us do good.
We will have another T2T story right here on our next show. Due to some scheduling conflicts, we were unable to have Darren Meenan from the Seven Line Army on this week's show. However, Darren will be on with us on an upcoming episode of the Terry Collins Show. And as always, we want to thank all of you for the likes, the views, the shares of this show. Please keep it up. give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if you can. Your support by liking and reviewing this show helps us a great deal. You can subscribe to The Terry Collins Show on your favorite podcast platform or on our YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/ The Terry Collins Show, and all of the past 2 seasons are on the channel as our special video highlights with all the guests that we've had on. That'll wrap up this edition of The Terry Collins Show. I want to remind everybody to check out Amazing Conversations with Jay Horowitz, a New York Mets podcast hosted by the foremost Mets historian. Each week, Jay brings on guests from all eras in Mets history. And this week, Jay brings on former Mets favorites R.A. Dickey and Benny Agbayani. Subscribe to it now. Amazing Conversations with Jay Horowitz, available on all podcast platforms and on YouTube. I want to thank the Terry Collins Show's creative director, as always, our good friend Marsh, and to our researcher, Dominic DiBiase. For Terry Collins, this is John Arezzi. We'll see you next time.